And she said, you're going to have to write down the order of things that you do. And she was right. I should have written down the order. Brother Len will speak on the topic, Angels Among Men, and we'll ask him to speak about 10 minutes over since we've gone over a bit. So go ahead.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Brother Chester. You know, people in this life are always seeking something better. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's business, whether it's sports, whether it's perfection. They're always looking for some quest to make themselves the best and to raise their level of ability. Today, without a doubt, the greatest area that people are looking at is self-fulfillment. How do I make my life better? How do I get more out of it? And they're not really content to just do it on themselves or rely on what we have in the scriptures. For those people that aren't religious, it's really looking for some inexplainable help from beyond. That's really what they're after. And so we see the things that come up today of tapping the inner self to try to bring out the best that's within you, the divine spark, if you have it within you. But probably the most significant thing, as far as we as Bible students should think about, is the fact that we find more and more people turning to celestial help. Not the kind of celestial help that we're used to with our Lord and our prayers to God and to Jesus intervening on our behalf. But they're prayers and their help of a celestial kind are angelic encounters. Today, 70% of the people believe in angels. That's a pretty astounding number when you think of the number of religious people there are. Now, almost half of that, 49% the last time a survey of this kind was done, believe that they had their own angel. The concept of guardian angels, which, you know, we have taught in the scriptures for years, at least, that God appoints over those who are desiring to follow him. But almost half believe that they have their own angel that takes care of them. I'm not sure if they take care of them when they're doing things they're not supposed to, but anyways. Remember 2 years ago, Hillary Clinton even made the theme of her Christmas tree, angels. We look today, you go in the bookstore, 5 out of the 10 bestsellers that you find describe some kind of encounter with celestial beings. And like anything, I'm firmly convinced that whatever special interest group there is in the country or the world, somebody writes a newsletter for it. I mean, look within the Bible student movement itself. We have so many newsletters. But we have, within the angelic celestial experience, we also have newsletters. One not too far from where I work in New Jersey, there's one called the Angel Watch newsletter. And the comment is, each of us has a guardian angel. They're non-threatening, wise, and loving beings. They offer help whether we ask for it or not. But mostly we ignore them. Now that sounds to me like a wife. Or a husband if you're female. But here's the attitude. Another, one of the more prevalent books, called The Book of Angels by Sophie Burnham, suggests that angels disguise themselves to be unrecognized. Quote, the rule is that people receive only as much information as they can bear in the form they can stand to hear it. That's pretty idealistic. I'd love to have that prevalent in today's news and today's, especially what's coming out of this area. But notice again the comment that, you know, celestial beings that help. Professor Robert Elwood at USC, who teaches in the philosophical area there, says, with angels around, people feel they don't have to bother an almighty God in order to get help. Now, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? Oh, let's not bother God. Let's just talk to the angels. I'm not sure where they think those angels come from. Now, there is, you remember the, if you've seen the Broadway play Angels in America or heard about it, Tony Kushner, the person that wrote that play, and it's really describing the depths and the difficulty of those dying with AIDS. But one of the statements he makes in this whole troubled area of angels, which I think sort of sums up the feelings many might have about this, says he was troubled by the fact that people claim angels appear to some and not others. I find it horrendously offensive. Why are you saved with your guardian angel and not the woman who was shot to death shielding her children in Brooklyn? That suggests a capricious divine force. If there is a God, he can't possibly work that way. That's a pretty good statement, I think, and one which people can certainly question. The conclusion that's generally reached from all this, I think summed up in one of the articles discussing angelic encounters of a current nature. To the degree that this search represents the triumph of hope over proof, it may be a good and cheering sign of our times. For all those who say that they have had some direct experience of angels, no proof is necessary. For those predisposed to doubt angels' existence, no proof is possible. And for those in the mystified middle, there is often a growing desire to be persuaded. If heaven is willing to sing to us, it is little to ask that we be ready to listen. So, quite a controversy surrounding this whole concept of angels. For us, looking at the scriptures, the controversy is not so great. Although perhaps it is, because I've encountered many that subscribe, perhaps, that there aren't celestial beings after all. But in Revelation, we have a description that sort of forms the basis for some of the discussion I'd like to take us into today. And it'll be abbreviated because we just don't have all the time to discuss it thoroughly. But in Revelation 7, verses 1 to 3, and many of the scriptures I won't read, so I'll give you the reference. Revelation 7, 1 to 3, we have the description of the four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, which is a term that's generally used to just mean the wide breadth of the earth. We use that a lot of times when we talk about the four corners of the earth. But in direct relationship to holding back a wind from across the earth. And it really is one wind that's being described as in four angels holding this back as a forbidding factor, some kind of restraint that's coming in an organized way that God is manipulating to hold back this wind from across the earth, calling for astute alertness on those that are watching, especially John as he's describing this event. And it breeds of the distinct description of spirit agencies and divine power. Now, Daniel, what gets us into that, of explaining this, Daniel saw a similar vision in his own seventh chapter that he records for us. Daniel 7, 2 to 7. Daniel describes this similar event, only now, as we read Daniel's description, we can see that he's discussing here the role of evil forces upon the earth. That's why Paul perhaps brings this home to us more than any other person and gets us into discussing and seeing what's going on in this vision in Ephesians, the sixth chapter. When Paul gives us some insight into our own battles. And Paul says in the sixth chapter of Ephesians, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness, against spiritual wickedness in high places. That spiritual wickedness, incidentally, if you look at the literal translation of that, means the spiritual hosts of the wickedness. Paul here is describing beings which are at war not with us, but against us. We'll come back to that a little bit later. So what's being described, I think, here in Revelation, the seventh chapter, that the release of these winds, notice that John talks about a release of this wind, occurs at the end of a period of time when those that are called, those that are members of this group he sees as 144,000, are sealed and perhaps even delivered. Turn to 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, verses 11 and 12. I think this is the whole point, summarizes what we see occurring in Revelation, the seventh chapter. For this cause God shall send strong delusions, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be condemned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And Paul is describing here the setting up of that period of time just prior to Christ's inauguration of his kingdom. So I think in this description that we have for us here, and as we think about this theme, we're discussing those beings who are counted as spreading havoc across the earth at the end of an age when the wind is released, having its source, as we'll see, in Genesis and the encounter and the promulgation we have there of the activity of angels at the beginning of this world. Fitting description also of an activity at the end of the world, not tied to what we see today in people's encounters, but of a much broader and more difficult nature. So the purpose that I want to cover today is really to take us through an examination of the origin of that activity, not just for a historical lesson, but then to be able to understand the kind of restraint that was put on under the guise of New Testament activity, and we can examine how Jesus gave us insight into that, so that those lessons can prepare us for understanding what John is describing here in Revelation and what Paul is telling us in Thessalonians, and preparing ourselves to understand what it is that perhaps that wind represents at the end of the age. Now, there are a lot of things I'd like to cover in this period of time, and I won't be able to. So let me at least mention the things I'd like to answer, and I won't be able to answer all of them. First, to look at Genesis 6, 1 and 2, where we have the first description of what I think are the angelic encounters given. Secondly, to say, if this did happen, an encounter of man and angels, how could it happen? What was the purpose of those angels on the earth in the first place? Fourth, what was the sin that they committed and why did it happen? Fifth, what happened to those angels? And that's perhaps one of the more important ones. Sixth, what are they doing now? And seventh, what about the future? So we'll see how many of those we can get through. Let's turn to Genesis 6, 1 and 2. This has always been a very mysterious passage. It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Now, who were the men beginning to multiply? Well, the Hebrew word there is the word Adam, which we recognize as man, plus the prefix ha, H-A. Now, there are three common uses for that term, usually in the scriptures, and I'll give you choice A, B, and C. And in the spirit of Jim yesterday, which is the correct answer? C. Mankind, the race, Adam, the individual, or as in Genesis 5:2, Adam and Eve. So we can eliminate the first two fairly rapidly because this is a rapid description of what's going on. When men began to multiply, when Adam and Eve began to multiply on the face of the earth, this description occurs for us in Genesis 6:1-2. Who are these sons of God that are mentioned here in this first and second verse? The Hebrew here is the term Beni Elohim. Now, Elohim we recognize as being used to describe usually beings of a heavenly nature. The word is used several places in the scriptures, and I won't read all these, but I will give you the citation. Job 38:7, Job 1 and 6, which you recognize as when the sons of God were walking back and forth, and Daniel 3:25. But the Septuagint version is what we look at in the Greek Old Testament for this Genesis 6:1-2. Rather than sons of God, describes it as angels of God. Now, some might say, well, messengers is also used of describing the term Elohim or calling sons of God. But the term for messenger, this is not usually the word that's used. When we find it either a human or a divine messenger of some kind, it's usually the word Malak, which means a messenger of some kind from God. There are three theories about what happens here, and the handout I've given you sort of summarizes what those are. There are some that would contend this is merely a description of the godly sons of Seth. There are others who would say it's the good line of the Hebrew kings. And I've given you the arguments, really, which pushes me to believe really we're talking about the angels here. It's the only one that really gives us consistently in the scriptures and the ability to harmonize where this is used in other places. And I'll leave that for you to study on your own. But the assumption is that we can rule out the two theories based on their own difficulties and come to the conclusion, as we have it here presented to us, that after the beginning of the human race, the propagation of the race, after they began to multiply, human women were visited by angelic visitants and bore children. And as obscure as some may think that sounds, it seems to be what God is presenting here to us. And in our day and age, it's very easy to dismiss these kinds of things, but yet it plays a very prominent part in the scriptures and gives us what I think are the origin of what we see later following through the scriptures in Christ dealing even with those beings who were of a fallen nature on a heavenly plane. Now, there's a lot of evidence we could look at. And, you know, even as we look at the ancient classics, we see some of these descriptions of how the gods looked on the humans and really, you know, took wives of all the women. And they brought forth the half-human, half-divine beings like Hercules and some of the others. I used to love Hercules when I was a kid. I loved the movies about Hercules. And so the whole concept was very prevalent in the Roman days, and even in Greek mythology we find it. In fact, if we look at Homer, I spent 4 years in Latin, and I'm not sure why I did that. I wasn't ever intending to be a doctor, but I guess it helped me with English a little bit. But Homer, as we look at Homer, he uses the same word for gods and demons in his writings. And after Homer, we find this description of heavenly beings, gods being intermediaries between God, the great gods, and men. And generally, in the whole description of literature, we find history of those who were imperfect beings, some good, some evil, that acted on behalf of mankind. Well, let's turn to our second question. How could this happen if we assume this is the correct understanding? You know, the scriptures record at least 40 instances of celestial beings having an encounter with man. So the ability to do that was evidenced throughout the scriptures. Let's just look at one example, or take one example. The two angels that met with Abraham. Remember when Abraham was outside his tent and there were two visitors that came along? Now, it doesn't really say they were angels, although Abraham comes to that conclusion. I think the reason he comes to that conclusion is we look at it, we can see it's the only answer that's evident to us. These two angels met with Abraham and announced that, you know, they were going to destroy Sodom because of its corruption. That's recorded in Genesis 18, 1 and 22. And then in Genesis 19, 1, we have the record of them going and appearing in Sodom to do that. Now, the subtleness, if you don't catch that transition between the 18th chapter and the 19th chapter, is in the description of when they left Abraham and when they got to Sodom. From the time of day that's presented there, it's only about 2 hours. But the distance from where Abraham was camped to Sodom was 40 miles. Now, I don't care how fast you run. If you're a human, you cannot make 40 miles in 2 hours. So the evidence and what we see internally presented for us in Genesis 19, these were heavenly beings and ambassadors sent to execute a specific commission by God of destruction upon this city. So we could ponder that perhaps that was the same thing that happened in the days of Genesis, the early days of Genesis. The likelihood that these angels, the sons of God that are mentioned in Genesis 6, had some commission from God. That ability, just as those angels in Genesis 18 and 19 had, to materialize and meet with Abraham as men, was prevalent in their ability too. But those abilities were not used to exercise the divine commission, but used for a selfish purpose that was corrupt. And you know, it's interesting because Genesis does not label these angels as sinners. That's only mentioned in the New Testament when we have the description. So their sin was apparently in the misuse of that power that they had. Well, let's think for a minute, what could be their divine commission on earth if that were true? You know, there's a lot of legends we mentioned about supernatural beings coming to earth to teach men all kinds of knowledge. We don't really know about that, but we do know there's a passage in Hebrews which is of some, discussion as to what time period this really applies. Hebrews 2:2-5, which we really won't read, but here the description is being given by the writer to the Hebrews about the words spoken by angels, that every transgression and every disobedience received a just recompense of reward. That's the way this starts out. So it seems to imply from this that there was a previous time when angels took a direct commission from God over this period. Now, some would say, well, if we look at Galatians 3:19, we see that it appears that Moses was given the law by angels, some of the lesser laws, that they took their role in applying this to God. So this is a description of the Jewish age and the giving of the law. But the problem is, if we look at that Hebrews passage itself, the word that's used there for earth in this passage is really discussing the habitable earth. It's the earth as distinct from an age. And you know, when we use the term in the New Testament, Ionos, it usually is referring to the Jewish age, the gospel age. But here it's speaking about the physical place of the earth. And it wasn't a period of time in the days of Moses that angels really had that ability to deal out the rewards. That was given by Moses and his 70 elders. So I think there's more support here. See, there's only really two times when a habitable earth is described in the scriptures. One is from creation to the flood, and the other is the time until now, when it says the earth wouldn't pass away. So that Hebrews 2:5 perhaps better applies to that period, not of Sinai, but the period of the pre-flood era. So that somehow those angels were given a divine commission, some beneficial purpose of perhaps giving knowledge to man to help him adapt to his new earth. Now, Brother Russell suggested in his comments on Hebrews 2:2 the same thing. You know, their commission was, well, they were given a commission to try to help man recover. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that concept that it was to try to help them recover, but I think it was a divine commission of some kind to help man learn what he needed to learn to survive outside the Garden of Eden. After all, God stationed the being, remember, at the entrance to the garden so they couldn't turn back there. So God did use those instrumentalities for that very purpose. Well, then let's look at the next question. What was their sin and why did they do it then? The place where we get our answer, and it's probably the best evidence we have in the scriptures that, you know, this is indeed what took place, is in Jude 6. It's really in Jude 6 where we get the answer about these angels and their sin. Jude 6, "And the angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness unto the judgment of the great day." Now that word that's used for habitation there in Jude 6 is the same word, and it's the only other place it's used in the scriptures, in 2 Corinthians 5:2, when it talks about us, those that are his followers. It says, "For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house, which is from heaven." It's talking about the celestial and terrestrial bodies. So what was it that Jude is saying they left? They left their spiritual body. That was the sin, or that was the commission which they did to commit the sin. They did not keep that estate, but gave it up for sinful purposes. You know, you say, why? I mean, if we look at today, I mean, what's the hope when everybody dies? They say, well, I'm going to get my wings. You know, they want to become an angel. Why would the angels do this sort of thing that Jude is saying? If we think about what Satan's purpose was, when we know God gave that, pronounced that judgment on Satan and said the seed of the woman would bruise his head, Satan knew that through the woman, his destruction would come from God. And so if woman could be corrupted, if that seed of woman could be corrupted, perhaps that promised seed would not be available to crush his head. And that appears to be the most likely source for the rule of why we see this sin being committed by the angels, that in some kind of a seduction, similar to what we had even with Adam and Eve, they were commissioned and they were persuaded that through their seed, since they were heavenly beings, they could perhaps improve man and lift man through their seed, because they would have been something other than ordinary humans. There's one interesting passage given to us in this Genesis 6 chapter that we sometimes neglect. In Genesis 6, 9, it says, "These are the generations of Noah leading up to the flood. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations." Now, let's look at that word perfect, because some say that means Noah was a perfect moral character. But the word that's used there is the word in Hebrew, tamen, which is means without blemish. And it's the same word that we have used in the tabernacle arrangements. Remember, in the tabernacle, we had sacrificial purity. The animals had to be without blemish. There could be no spot, nothing on them. Remember the red heifer that was used in the tabernacle sacrifices. It said that had to be without blemish. That term is used in both Leviticus and Exodus and in Numbers 19:2 to portray that same concept. So it's not really Noah's perfection, moral perfection, is being described as much as the fact that it's very likely what we're having described here is that this infiltration of the angels with man had gone to every generation on the earth other than Noah's. And so it was that perhaps these angels were seduced by Satan into thinking they could reverse this difficult process that man had gotten into, the death process, that through their seed being something other than human, they could do God's service better by having children, which would escape the sentence of death. Now, we don't have time to look at all the possibilities that are suggested by this, but let's look at in that Genesis 6, 1 and 2, when the term is given to us that there were giants on the earth in those days. This seems to be the result of whatever happens in Genesis 6, 1 and 2. The word there for giants, in many translations you will see it not translated and just left as the word Nephilim. There are several possibilities being suggested for what this word means. I'm only going to give you the one I think is the best example because it's based on the scriptures. If you're interested in the other two, I'll be glad to share those with you, at least the other two possibilities. And it further supports the concept of what we're talking about here. That Nephilim is really a contraction of two well-recognized Hebrew words that we know, and that's the word nephesh, which we have that we use for the breath of life, and the word Elohim, which is used, as we said before, for angels. So when we think of the word nephesh, God is adding the word Elohim to that, calling them Nephilim. Now, think about how this was used before when life was given to someone before. For example, when Abraham's name was changed. Abram's name was changed to Abraham, representing that breath of life coming from God. Sarai's name was changed to Sarah, with that idea of the breath of life coming from God, giving them some new commission in life. And so here, the concept, the breath of life coming from the angels, is being part of what was intended to propagate a race that would be above humans. And even though they were intended to be half human and half divine, the description that we're given in Genesis and even elsewhere gives us a description of a race that came out of that was so difficult and so hard to manage. Monsters, abortions, no life and no happiness, but continual corruption. We have it described in many places. And it wasn't a life of happiness that came out of this at all, but it was a life of difficulty and misery. One passage, if I can find my book. Oops, I guess I left it. That book right under the hymn book. Thank you. I don't mean to be apocryphal here by reading something other than the scriptures, but the book of Enoch, you know, was in use in our Lord's day, and I think he sanctioned at least some validity to it. And I just want to read a description. You'll read, see, very similar to what we have in the scriptures here from Enoch, the 7th chapter. It happened after the sons of men had multiplied in those days that daughters were born to them, elegant and beautiful. And when the angels, the sons of heaven, beheld them, they became enamored of them, saying to each other, "Come, let us select for ourselves wives from the progeny of men, and let us beget children." And the women conceiving brought forth giants, or that's the word Nephilim, whose stature was 300 cubits. These devoured all which the labor of men produced until it became impossible to feed them, when they turned themselves against men in order to devour them, and began to injure birds, beasts, reptiles, and fishes, to eat their flesh one after another and to drink their blood. Then the earth reproved the unrighteousness. Now that's the description that God gives to us in Genesis when he says the earth had become so corrupt and man had become so corrupt that he had to destroy it. You know, it's really at God's end. You think about the world today and you say, boy, you know, this is pretty bad. Think of what it must have been so much that God said we have to destroy it or the end will never escape. Well, what happened to the angels themselves then? We think those progeny died in the flood, and from Isaiah's description in Isaiah 26, it appears that because they were not human, they would not get a resurrection. It solves that problem because they were really not human beings at all, and God really was, in essence, starting over with Noah and his family. But Jude 6 tells us that those angels then were kept in what he calls chains of darkness, and he uses a term here of Tartaru. Now, there's been so much speculation about what that means and what that word means. I think, once again, Peter, in using this term, when he uses it in 2 Peter 2:4, he's the one that gives us the supply that these angels that kept not their first estate were kept in chains of darkness in Tartarus. Peter took his allusions from many of these descriptions. And what it appears to be that this term Tartarus was used by the Greeks to describe just an imprisoned state, neither in heaven or neither on earth. For those that they described were in the half-demigods that were sent away from the earth. But it appears what was taken away was the ability that they had, and that's what seems to be described by this term Tartarus, the power of materialization, the power that had been abused that was inherent with the angelic nature to pronounce a divine commission was taken away, and that was banished. I just refer you to the question book, page 146, where Brother Russell comments, and I think it's a pretty good comment, that says that Tartarus was an act, not a place. In other words, it was the ability that was taken away from them to materialize. It had nothing to do with the fact that they're not Earth's atmosphere, not heaven's atmosphere. But the idea is that they were taken away to a point where they could not again deal with man the way they had before. And so we have the descriptions of Jesus even given to us when it talks about by his death or at his death he witnessed to those spirits in prison. But we need to move on to what are they doing now, because it's really the crux of what we're after when we discuss what lies before us. It's the New Testament that really gives us the answer. You know, there's 36 occurrences of what we would attribute to demon possession. And again, that's a word today that many just don't subscribe to. But yet, Jesus encountered it in his day. And what do you do with those? We can explain them away as, you know, Jesus was promulgating psychological warfare against people that were diminished. But yet, one particular incident, that of the Gadarene swine, is very difficult for us to escape, but it gives us the best clue as to exactly what we have, what situation we have today, waiting for Revelation 7 to take place. In Luke 8:31, actually the incident is recorded in Matthew, the 8th chapter, from verses 28 to 34. I won't read the whole thing, but I call your attention to another passage describing the same thing in Luke 8:31. So if you just note those two passages, Matthew 8:28-34 and Luke 8:31, remember the incident that Jesus encountered the demonic, and those called on him recognized that Jesus was the Son of God and had authority over him, and they begged him not to cast them out, but to send them into the swine that finally ended up going over the cliff. But the word that's used in Luke 8:31 is interesting, because it says they besought him, they being those demons that were there, that he would not command them to go out into the deep. Now that's the word that's used describing the abyss in Revelation. So the idea is that they feared being returned again to a place where they could not have contact with mankind. Well, it didn't do any good, because Jesus cast them out anyways, but it's a place where we get the description of what this idea or concept of their imprisonment is about. Similar to what we have described when we have in Revelation 20 verses 1 and 2, Satan put into the abyss. In other words, the ability is taken away for contact with mankind. Ephesians 6:12. If we go back to that for a moment, when Paul tells us we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness, spiritual wickedness in high places. Paul tells us here, we aren't dealing with physical enemies. All the flesh, the devil, those kinds of things he talks about in other places. But he says, we're in a battle here with the spiritual hosts of wickedness. Remember what I told you, that's the literal rendering here. We are aligned with God. They were aligned for evil and evil purposes. It's not that they war on us, but notice what Paul says. They war against us. Their purpose is not our purpose. And so we must battle with spiritual tools. A mispassage in Daniel 10, one that I find very interesting. Daniel 10, 11 to 13. Remember, Daniel was praying to have the vision interpreted to him? And Gabriel finally came and visited him and said, I heard you from the first day that you were preaching, and we heard you. But I was withstanding the prince of Persia at that time. And I stayed there until Michael came to give me relief. That's a description of spiritual forces at work. That was the war, I think, that Paul's talking about here, a war that's unseen, the one that we're battling against, and one which perhaps in the future gets even more prevalent. Let's look at the future. What about today? When Jesus cast out these demons and their ability to contact, they could not materialize. Their contact with man could only come through the willingness of those to submit themselves in their mind to manifest the wishes and desires of these. And yes, perhaps today, I mean, as many dismiss it, the possibility of possession is still there. The occult that we see, the encounters that you see with UFOs, all these things describe very aptly the sorts of subtle mind games that can be played. Even many of the things we see in the New Age movement coming before us fall into this kind of a category. Behavioral psychology, while I think some of it is very apropos, it delves into some areas which really involve submitting oneself to divine sparks within. And that's really when we get into the difficulties that were there when man first started to deal with these angels. And perhaps the comparison that Jesus gives us to the days of Noah in leading up to the time of the end are not just for sake of ignorance, but perhaps even the problems that occur that we've seen happen in Genesis 6. So for us, we need to follow this admonition of Ephesians 6 to put on the whole armor of God. God has told us that we are exempt as long as we stay in Him. In Revelation 7, the description is not for those that remain on the earth of His children, but after His children are gone. Putting on the armor, not turning our mind to the things of this world. Ephesians 6:18. Is a scripture I'd like to close with. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for the saints. So let us be ever on the alert that we are not dealing with spiritual or with fleshly enemies. We're dealing with our life on a spiritual nature. And we need to stay close to God to make sure He is able to help us through the difficult times that we encounter.
Thank you, Brother Len. That was very good. And he's asked us to close with him 1:30.